matter of Noah's Ark is one of tremendous fascination to many people. I suppose back from the time we've been children, we've encountered Noah's Ark in our coloring books and so forth, and we're aware of it, but somehow we never have taken it very seriously. We know it's in the Bible, but it's one of those old stories that we don't really know for sure whether it really happened or not. And the way it's pictured in the children's coloring books, of course, is just a sort of a little toy boat with giraffes' necks sticking out the windows and so on, and we don't really take it too seriously. But we should take it seriously. Noah's Ark, we believe fully, really existed and really marks the transition between the world that God created in the beginning and the world that now is, separated by the waters of the great flood. And the ark provided the bridge across from one world to the other world. We believe there's good evidence that it's still preserved in an old frozen lake, perhaps a stationary glacier up on the high slopes of Mount Ararat in Turkey. And for a background for this discussion, let me read some of the passages dealing with it. In the sixth chapter of Genesis, we have the first mention, of course, as the flood is about to be visited upon the earth. In verse 13 of Genesis chapter 6, God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." Now note that not only is man to be destroyed, but the earth is to be destroyed. I will destroy them with the earth. The earth is man's dominion. And by this time, man had scattered over the entire face of the earth that God had told him to do, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He had told Adam, and verse 1 of chapter 6 of Genesis says, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and then of course right here it says, the earth has been filled with violence, and in order to be filled with violence, it had to be filled with people, and so the whole world has been populated by this time in history, and in order to destroy the race of mankind, he must also destroy the earth, not annihilate the earth, but change its face so drastically that the world after the flood was different than the one before. And then he says to Noah in verse 14, "Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark," or literally cells or nests, sort of compartments, cages you might say, "and pitch it within and without with pitch." Now this is not petroleum pitch, but some kind of resin. And it's interesting that the word itself in the original is the same as the word for atonement. It's a covering. The atonement is a covering of our the sins of men. The life of the flesh, he says, is in the blood. And I've given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, a covering for your souls. It's the blood that makes an atonement for the soul. Well, that's the same word. This is a covering to provide an ark of safety within which God's people could be preserved through the awful judgment of the great flood. And covering this ark was this material, whatever it may have been, which provided a watertight, safe compartment for them. Verse 15, "This is the fashion which thou shalt make it of. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, the height of it 30 cubits. Now, the cubit, most people believe, is about 18 inches. It quite possibly could have been 24 inches. The least that anyone has ever suggested it could have been was 17 and a half inches. And even if we take the smallest, 17 and a half inches as equivalent to the cubit, if you work this out and compare it with what we know today as a sort of a compartment or vehicle for transporting animals, most obvious would be a railroad stock car. And you can work it out. A standard railroad stock car, we know about the size of it. We know about how many animals it would carry. It would carry about 240, it works out, animals the size of sheep. And this ark would carry the equivalent of 522 or more, at least that many, standard railroad stock cars. So it could carry a tremendous number of animals. The old skeptical jibe at the story of the ark that it just couldn't hold two of every kind of animal is simply not so. Men have just simply not calculated. It could easily carry two of every known kind of animal that lived in the dry land, past or present, in about half or less of its capacity. Then he built a window all around the ark, and and so on. First, second, and third stories, he built it in. They had three decks, probably the larger animals on the bottom and the smaller on the second deck, and then plenty of room on the top deck for Noah and his family to live. And in verse 19, he says, "Of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee. They shall be male and female," and so on. And then verse 20, towards the end of it, says, "Two of every sort shall come to thee to keep them alive." So Noah didn't have to go out into Australia and Alaska to find animals. God sent them to him. I don't know, perhaps by imparting to the animals that he wanted preserved some kind of new information in their genetic code, you might say, giving them the ability to migrate. Now, animals today have that ability. Before the flood, they didn't need that ability because the climate was warm and mild everywhere. There were no extreme changes of temperature with the winter. So they didn't need these special physiologic abilities to cope with inclement weather, but now they're going to. So God directs some of them to come to Noah. And, of course, once they got in the ark, then I think he also gave them the ability to hibernate after they had settled down and been fed and so forth. Of course, animals today have that ability. At least implicitly they do. Not all of them use it, but many of them do, and all of them probably have it programmed into them that they could use it if necessary. Nobody understands too much these capacities of hibernation and migration. They're still quite mysterious, physiological capacities. But at least this is a possible explanation of what happened here. And so they simply hibernated mostly through the year of the flood. Now, Noah obeyed God, and then when the time came for the flood, down in verse 7, it says, "Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, into the ark. And all of them went in, two by two, the clean animals by seven. And then the flood came, and the ark was borne upon the face of the waters." Over in verse 18, it says, "The waters prevailed and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth. And all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered, and all flesh died," and so on. So that the waters finally covered the very highest mountain. This would include Mount Ararat, but I think we would have to visualize the present mountain ranges and mountain peaks as formed either during or subsequent to the flood. They were not the pre-diluvian mountains that the waters rose above. There was a drastic change in topography and geography at the time of the flood. But finally, when the waters went down and the ark landed, it landed upon what then had become Mount Ararat. Down in verse 4 of chapter 8, "The ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat." Now, it does mention the mountains of Ararat, and it is significant that there are two mountains, as you'll see, both called Mount Ararat. One is Big Ararat, one is Little Ararat. And probably that's the reference, because these mountains have been so named from a far past history. As far as we know, these have always been their names, and that region has been called by that name. But these are the two mountains that would be most likely to be associated with this occurrence. Now, note the ark rested on the 17th day of the seventh month. The flood had come on the 17th day of the second month, so it had been 5 months of floating around the world until finally the ark grounded. The waters had to stop going up and begin to go down before the ark could rest on the mountain. And then it was the 10th month, it says in the next verse, on the first day of the month, that the tops of the mountains could be seen. So as they were resting on Mount Ararat, it was still 3 more months almost, 2.5 months, before they could even see the tops of the lower mountains in the vicinity around them. But finally the waters went down, and they came out of the ark. Verse 13 says, "It came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark, and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. And then in verse 16, God said, Go forth from the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons wives with thee. Bring forth with thee every living thing that's with thee, of all flesh, both fowl and cattle and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and so on, that they may be fruitful and multiply in the earth. And they went forth. And then they went down the mountain. Now, undoubtedly, there were still very catastrophic conditions in the world for a long time to come. The earth was settling down into new hydrologic and physiographic and tectonic balances. But it would have taken centuries before it would have become more or less the normal, stable, semi-stable condition that we have today. But they were able to survive. The world was different, but they could still live, and they had been delivered from the awful wickedness of the world before the flood. Now they left the ark, and no mention further is made of the ark in the Old Testament. So far as the record goes, it just stayed up there on Mount Ararat. And the temperature changed, and the snows began to come, and Mount Ararat, either during or after the flood, was elevated to some 17,000 feet elevation, which is what it is now. And now often, and it's completely covered with snow, and all of the time it's partially covered with snow and ice. There are great glaciers up on the top of it, very rugged volcanic mountain, very precipitous, very dangerous, subject to earth movements, to volcanic explosions, and many other things. Now, it's interesting that we have no other reference to the ark in the Old Testament, but we do have certain references in the New Testament. And here it's interesting that the references to the ark seem to have a bearing on the testimony that that ark had to the people of Noah's day. For example, in 1 Peter, rather, the third chapter, it says that there were certain people who were disobedient in the days of Noah while the ark was preparing. It seems to suggest that Noah, while he was building the ark, was calling men to repentance, and they had the great testimony of the ark that was going to deliver them from the waters of the flood that were coming, but they were disobedient to the word, and they wouldn't pay any attention, and they just went on about their own ways. And so they were not saved. It mentions in 2 Peter chapter 2 that Noah was a preacher of righteousness to the people of his generation. But they didn't care. The flood finally came in, it says, upon the world of the ungodly. God didn't spare them at all. He was a preacher of righteousness, but they were disobedient to the preaching of the word, in spite of the testimony of the ark that they had before them. And then another reference to the ark is in Matthew 24, when the Lord Jesus said, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man." They were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. They observed not, it says, they saw not or knew not or observed not until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And then the flood came and destroyed them all. And so there was the ark waiting to deliver them, but they paid no attention right up to the very day that the flood came and destroyed them all. And he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. People will be negligent. They won't care. The testimony of the word of God goes forth and they pay no attention. But one day judgment is going to come again, just as it did in the early days. And one last reference to the ark in Hebrews 11. It says, "By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, whereby he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith." That verse in Hebrews begins and ends with the phrase, "by faith." By faith Noah, being warned of God of things he had never seen. The uniformitarian scientists of his day undoubtedly scoffed at him. They said, "We have never seen rain. A flood isn't going to come." They'd never even seen a local flood, let alone a worldwide flood. And they didn't believe him. Noah was warned of God of things never seen as yet. But moved with godly fear, he went ahead and did what God commanded and prepared an ark to the saving of his house. He didn't save the world. They wouldn't hear, but he did save his own house. And thereby, it says, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. Well, we don't know, but we just suppose that it's possible, at least, that perhaps this same testimony of the great ark that was such a witness to the antediluvian world may possibly bear testimony once again to this world of our day. Because for the past 100 years especially, there have been many sightings reported of the ark on Mount Ararat. Some have flown over it, taken pictures, although we haven't been able to find the pictures, really. We know people that have seen them. Others report that they were actually able to climb up to the mountain and see it, and some even to enter it. As you go further back in history, there are many testimonies among ancient historians of the existence of the Ark high on the slopes of Mount Ararat, people in the Armenian nation near the mountain. In many cases, well, they believe it's there, and some at least claim they have seen it. But even to this very day, we are not able to go directly to it and say, here it is. But in the last 20 years or so, there have been a number of expeditions outfitted, most of them coming from this country, some from England and other places, trying to find the Ark. And none of them have yet been successful in actually locating it. Some have come back with pieces of wood, which seem perhaps to be part of the Ark. But the urge is there. Some have called it the Ark fever. There's just enough indication that it's really there to where people want to go and see if they can't find it. And it's amazing how many people want to. But of course it isn't an easy matter. And there have been a number that have gone, tried, and have been able to explore parts of the mountain. And some are very actively engaged. I think your church here has been particularly interested in this because you've had speakers here. And your own pastor is one of the directors of Search Foundation. John Bradley, one of your leading members, is president of Search. And these have been for many years trying to outfit expeditions and climb the mountain and explore it and perhaps find the Ark. And there is some indication that they know the possible location. But it's going to be very difficult and expensive to really excavate it and demonstrate it. Others, Mr. Cummings, Earl Cummings, has made many expeditions. His wife wrote a book last year, which we published, called Noah's Ark, Fact or Fable, and it's in the store if you want to get it. And he's made many studies, and they have done a great deal of research, finding out the traditions and trying to track down the reports. John Warwick Montgomery now has a book out on the subject, and he also has sort of gotten into the exploration, into the Ark, has been smitten by Ark fever, as it were. Well, we couldn't be out of it, too, at our Institute for Creation Research. We had to have an interest in it. Not that we seek for any particular prestige of our own, but we do desire to do whatever we can to see that this great testimony is given to the world in these days. And so we thought that perhaps it might be worthwhile, and all of us have been more or less in communication, Cummings and Search and so forth, with each other, so that it's not a matter of competition, but hopefully of cooperation. And we felt that perhaps this summer we might take a sort of a low profile, a tourist approach, rather than an expedition. And so five young men, well, one wasn't so young, but most of them were. John here is typical. He got the group together, and they went through some training and finally were able to go over and look for the Ark. And now I don't want to take any more from him because the story is rather exciting. They didn't find it, but at least they kind of, we believe, are sort of zeroing in. And one of these days, Lord willing, someone, we believe, God is going to show. And it's going to come forth once again as a great testimony of God's saving grace for those who come to the Ark of Safety in the Lord Jesus Christ, and God's judgment upon those who reject and disobey His word. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. There was a flood one time. There's going to be a fire next time. Well, now I'm going to turn it over to John. John is my second son. He's an engineer. Works for the city of Los Angeles. He's taken a leave of absence for this particular project. He's done some other research projects for us at the Institute. And has been, he believes, really called of God to do this work. So, John, it's all yours.
On Mount Ararat this summer, we had so many close calls, so many times when we just really faced death, that when I say I'm glad to be here, you can believe it. I really am. Now, the story I'm going to tell you tonight is not really our story of what we did this summer. The story I'd like to tell you is how God provided for us and led us and blessed us on this trip. This was a wonderful trip, and the Lord really just took over the whole thing and guided every step of the way. It was, to make a long story short, amazing. To give you an example, the first thing that happened in Turkey, you know, we had blown. From the States, I had rented a Hertz minibus for the summer for Turkey. And when we got there, we expected it at the airport. It wasn't there. And so we had to brave the Turkish taxi cabs and get a hotel. Well, come to find out, someone from the States, between the time we had left the States and arrived in Turkey, had cablegrammed Hertz in the car in Turkey and canceled our order. Well, here we were stranded in a strange country with no transportation. Well, the Lord provided. That next morning, we were just going to catch a bus out to the military base, and we got on the wrong bus, and we met an Air Force sergeant. We got to talking. Coming to find out, this fellow was a Christian, a friend of missionary friends of mine in Turkey, and he just happened to know of a VW 1971 minibus for sale, cheap, and we could afford it, and 2 days later we had bought it and were on our way to Arad. Now, you don't know the laws in Turkey, but it's impossible to buy a car in Turkey, but we did it. The Lord did so many impossible things for us and to us this summer. Around most borders of most countries, there is kind of a buffer zone where, by mutual agreement, neither country allows air traffic close to the border. Now, Ararat is right on the border, and this buffer zone applies to Ararat. People say, well, why don't you just get a helicopter and go up and find the Ark? You know, stop looking, just go find it. Well, it's not that easy because helicopters are just really not possible. Again, this can be theoretically overruled, but it never really has been. So Russia definitely does play a big part in the search. Now, some of the other groups that have been involved in the search before, Mr. Cummings, Earl Cummings was mentioned. Now, he and I are pretty good friends, and we've talked at great length about his research, where he thought it was. And I basically went to Ararat with this knowledge, and that's about all I had, the knowledge that he had imparted to me. In fact, last year, I was to be a member of his expedition to go as a climber, just, you know, to work for him to climb the mountain. But at the last moment, the trip canceled out, and the guy didn't get the official permits, and things went wrong and whatnot. And through that, we at the Institute began to think, well, maybe there's a better way. And so we decided to have our own expedition and try to eliminate some of his mistakes. Basically, our plan was to do all the work ourselves, not hire any of the locals. I learned Turkish, and this eliminated many of the problems. We backpacked in and backpacked out, very few mules and donkeys and horses and things, which have been the mainstay of these other expeditions. It was a lot of work. In fact, I lost about 35 pounds in 6 weeks. But we had a very successful expedition. We are running a little late. I won't say anything more. Why don't we just have some slides? Big Ararat is on the left. Little Ararat is on the right. Little Ararat is about 11,000 feet, and Big Ararat is 17,000. Doesn't look like it, but Little Ararat is almost in the foreground in this picture. This is the wrong side of the mountain. The search does not concentrate on this side of the mountain. Now, this is the right side, the north side. On the northeast face is what's known as the Ahura Gorge, named for a town named Ahura, right at the foot of the gorge. It's a pie-shaped section cut out right out to the heart of the mountain. It was blown out probably at the time of the flood or soon after, and has been increased and accented since. Now, you see in the upper right of the picture a kind of a semicircular cutout on the face of the gorge. That's referred to as the Sahinandare, and I'll mention that several times in the talk, so remember where that is. You can always locate it by the thick ice cap at the top of it. That ice cap is probably 200 to 300 feet thick. I mentioned Russia causes problems. Well, there's Russia.
in the background there. Right at the foot of the mountain is a border, and beyond that is Russia. There's many dangers there, not only Russia. The road to the mountain is somewhat dangerous, if you can find it. Now, down in the center of the picture, the lower center, is a little white dot. That's a tent. A guy lives there. Now, right, one day two of us were walking, and we were near that guy's tent when a pack of wolf dogs, attacked us, about 10 of them. They surrounded us and moved in on a circle, and we were defenseless. The Lord provided again there. I thought we were gone on that one. This fellow here ran out and helped break up the pack. The guy must have had 1,000 children running around. He invited us in his tent for some tea and some of the most, what, yogurt. Boy, it was really, really awful. The local people usually don't cause any trouble, at least during the daytime. At night, they can sometimes be a little belligerent, as you see by the bullet hole in the side of our car. One night, I wasn't camped there at the time, but the two guys that were woke up in the middle of the night with bullets screaming around, and one of them hit the car right next to the tent. Mount Ararat is a really rugged mountain. Now, all of the people that had told me anything about it had said, be careful, it's rugged. That's more rugged than you can imagine, and I imagine the worst, but little did I know. So we went into training. We trained on Mount Hood, which is in Oregon. We trained for glacial travel, crevasse rescue, self-arrest, just methods of glacial survival. Now, you'd think ice and snow would be the same anywhere, and maybe it is, but we were prepared for the ice and snow, but what we weren't prepared for was Mount Ararat. Come to find out, Mount Ararat is right in an earthquake zone. There's all the rock in the whole area is just twisted and turned and set up on end and crumbled. You can see the rock is just crumbling and falling apart. Everywhere you look, you can just walk up to that rock and just break off a piece just as big as you want. It's crumbly. It has no strength whatsoever. The whole area is like this. Now, all of these last slides that were right at the foot of the mountain, and we expected to find the same thing on Ararat, and sure enough, we did. Rocks everywhere. This picture was taken in the middle of the gorge. You walked all the way back into it. Avalanches coming down on us by the minute. Many times we had to run for cover. You can see all this loose rock in the foreground. Actually, that's glacier covered with loose rock. The black mass in the center, rear of the picture, is what's known as a black glacier. Solid ice, but black as coal. Now, I think in 1970, Earl Cummings, on one of his expeditions, took a picture, and when he got home, several months later, he was looking at his pictures, and he noticed an object way off in the distance, and it appeared to be about the size and shape, and, you know, it might have been the Ark, and everybody got really excited, and everybody kind of still is excited. Now, he thought he knew where it was, and I had talked to him. I knew what he thought, I thought. So anyway, we were going to try to find that object again, the first thing. Now, this is his picture. You see that object hidden out there in the rocks in the center, just to the left of the center? Now, that looks like something in there, doesn't it? You see what I'm talking about? Well, maybe I can... Right there. It does tend to look like an object. So we tried to find that same object, and we hunted and hunted, and for a while, until this afternoon, I thought we had found it. We found an object right there. Can you see that? I had seen that other picture many times, but we didn't have it in our possession at the time. And we found this object. It looks very similar, but and comparing the two pictures this afternoon, come to find out they're not the same. But at the time, I thought probably this was the same object. But as we approached it, we got closer and closer. The object in this picture is up a little higher, up near the top of the picture. As we approached it, it began to look more and more like a rock, and it was a rock, I'm convinced. But we couldn't get all the way to it because of the avalanches coming down on us every minute, just continuously. We were subjected to avalanches. Well, so we decided to go up above and try to look at it from above, because obviously we couldn't get to it from below. Well, we made it to the top of the Sahinandair. Now, that's no easy feat. In fact, as far as I know, we're the first ones ever to make it up that particular slope. Some other people have come up the other side of the mountain and crossed the glacier to get here. But as far as I know, these pictures are the only ones available of this area. Now, that ice cap in the rear is, remember, 300 feet thick or so. But we're looking for an arc that's 300 cubits, probably 1.5 times as long as that thing is thick. Now, that's a big arc. And I think you'll agree with me that the arc, there's no room for it. Not only would we not see it, but there's no room for it in this particular area. What we found up there is quite amazing. The crumbling rock everywhere. And I'll show you where it goes. This rock falls down and then onto a slope. The slope is pretty steep. And the whole Sahinandair, the semicircular portion of the gorge, turns into one huge funnel going straight down. Rocks every minute, hundreds of miles an hour, just flying down this thing. And they empty into the little gully where we had seen our little object. It's one of my favorite slides. Right down at the bottom of that funnel is this little fairy castle, I call it. But right around the corner from the little castle is our object, whatever it was. Again, we couldn't see it from this angle. But scientifically, we determined that due to the avalanches, due to the ruggedness of the area, due to the fact that 500 feet is, it's just too big for the area, the arc couldn't be in this area. So we ruled out this area as a possible location for the ark, and we began to search elsewhere on the mountain. The slope where I'm standing to take the picture is at about a 30-degree angle already, and the rest of that stuff just gets steeper and steeper. It doesn't look it. We didn't think so at the time, but believe me, it is. Well, so we climbed on up, dodging rocks throughout the day. It took us about 8 hours to get up to that little island in the snow up near the top. You see that? The rock island in the middle of the Finger Glacier? Now, when we got up there, that's about 13,500 foot elevation. It's way on up the mountain. And nobody in his right mind would ever go to such a place. But here we were, and as we got to that island, we heard somebody hollering at us. It can't be, but again he hollered, and we looked around, and there was a fella up on the slope off to the left. And he was hollering at us in Turkish. And I couldn't tell what he was hollering, but he did have a gun, and it was pointed at us. And the gist of what he was saying was, get off the mountain, or I'll shoot you. Well, so I hollered back in Turkish a little bit, told him that we had permission, that we were friends of the army, and, you know, we were going to climb the mountain anyway. And he didn't care. He said, get off the mountain, or he'd shoot us. Well, this went on for a while, and he meant it. I really believe he meant it. So we just sat down there on that rock, and we told the Lord and said, Lord, you've told us to climb the slope to look for your ark. We feel that today you're going to show us the ark. Well, we got to get up the slope first, so you take care of this fella. And we turned our backs on him, walked away, and never saw the guy again. I don't know who he was or why he was or what he was doing there, but the Lord took care of him. Now, as we had several close calls that day, probably 6 or 7 times we barely escaped from the avalanches. Then we ran into this Kurdish fellow with the gun. Soon after that, we had a very narrow escape with a crevasse right to the right of the little rock island. And it began to snow. And it began to snow and blow, and the wind was blowing really hard, and the snow was coming down in such torrents that it was hard to see, even with our snow goggles. We roped up and continued to climb, but we couldn't even see one another. It was so, the snow was so thick. Well, we decided to get off the glacier because we just couldn't see what we were doing. We crossed to the rocks over on the left and began to climb up the rocks. We're right near the ridge, you know, maybe 100 feet from the very top, but it's so steep up there, 100 feet is a long way. But as we got over here to these big rocks, it started to thunder and lightning. And it was all around us. We weren't, you know, below a thunderstorm. We were in it. We were in the clouds. The clouds were beneath us and above us and all around us. And the thunder would clap and, you know, we were right in it. And the lightning was striking every rock all around us just continuously. Most frightening thing. We had metal ice axes, of course. They were just humming with the static electricity. My hair was standing straight up on end. My mustache was sticking straight out. Boy, it was. Well, so we continued to climb towards the ridge. And as we climbed near this rock, we were kind of trying to gain some shelter from the blowing wind and whatnot. And as we were beneath this rock, lightning struck the rock, and in doing so, struck us. Now, not too many people have been struck by lightning and lived to tell about it, but again, the Lord was with us. The lightning blew us off the top of the mountain, just in the air, flying through the air, down the slope that we had just come up. I landed probably 50 feet away and was rolling down the mountain, couldn't see, I was blind, and I wasn't able to move very well. Finally, I grabbed hold of that rock, it's right in front of the fellow that's standing there, and was able to stop myself. I turned around and called for help, but I realized that there was another guy calling for help right behind me, and I realized we'd all been hit. Well, to make a long story short, I tried to get up and found, to my dismay, that both legs were entirely paralyzed. That they were in great pain. He felt like they were on fire, actually, that, you know, my clothing was on fire. I really thought it was. Another fellow that was behind me, who had also stopped in the snow, he was also paralyzed from the waist down. The third fellow, Roger, who you see standing here, was blown out even farther, and he was unconscious, lying face down in the snow. We couldn't walk to him to help him or anything. We were stranded there. Finally, though, he woke up and came walking up to us. He was white as a ghost, and as he approached us, you know, we asked him to help, and he just kind of looked with a strange look in his eyes. He says, "Where are we? What are we doing here?" He didn't know who he was, who we were, why we were, what we were doing there. I mean, we were in bad need of help, and he didn't even like us. He wondered who these nuts were sitting there in this snow doing this blizzard. He wanted to go up and sit under that rock and get out of the snow. Well, we were in a situation, quite frankly, that we just had to pray to God for a miracle of healing, or we would have been dead within a few hours. We would have frozen to death in the blizzard, or died of exposure through the night, or maybe fallen down the slope even farther. Well, thank the Lord that within an hour, the strength had returned to my legs somewhat, and I was able to stand. And once I could do that, I went around the mountain gathering up all the gear that had been blown off and scattered around, and put all of Roger's warm gear on him, and as he began to get warm, his memory began to come back, and he began to function a little better. Up until then, he'd stay away from us. He'd kind of go off and sulk somewhere. we pulled the other fella, JB, over into an area that was a little sheltered. And we just huddled there together underneath a tarpaulin and whatnot and just had a good old-fashioned prayer meeting for maybe a couple hours. We just prayed. Now, it may sound funny, but I've really never felt the presence of the Holy Spirit like I did right then. It felt like we were in a war between Satan and God. And even though we were lying there half dead, we all had that peace that God had won. And in fact, he had won many years ago on Calvary. He had defeated Satan then. And that's how we prayed. We just claimed the promise that God had defeated Satan then, and that this battle that was going on now was kind of senseless, and we just claimed that and just told God to take over from here. Well, within a couple hours, the lightning had stopped, and Roger and I went to the top of the ridge and picked out a place to camp. Now, the wind was only blowing about 60 miles an hour up there, and we were dreaming, thinking we could pitch a tent, but that was the only thing we could do. We had to get shelter because we were on the verge of hypothermia, I'm sure. Well, we went back down and got JB. And during the time we were gone, JB's strength in his legs had returned. He had no feeling, well, neither did I either. But the strength had come back in order to enable him to stand. And so the three of us then walked to the top of the mountain. And just as we got to the top of the ridge, the wind stopped, the skies broke, and it was a beautiful afternoon. We were able to pitch a tent, get some hot food and liquids in us, and it even got rather warm that afternoon. Now, I hadn't forgotten that today was the day we were supposed to find the Ark, so I went scouting around a little on my own but didn't find it. But it was a special day. The Lord really took care of us that day. Well, I told you we decided to look at some other parts of the mountain. We went around to the right on the glacier. Once we got up on the ice cap, travel was rather easy, even though it was knee-deep snow usually, and we had to watch for crevasses and things. We were looking for an area that was a stationary glacier, one in which the Ark could have been preserved. Because you see, if a glacier moves with tremendous force, and nothing could stand in its way, not rock, particularly not a wooden structure. So you're going to find the Ark someday in a stationary glacier or snow that just doesn't move. Well, we found several areas that look like that. You see these wrinkles in the snow. It's called an ice fall. It's like a waterfall, only it's ice. It's like rapids right there. The Ark couldn't be in that area because that's moving. We found an ice cliff. Maybe that's rock with an ice covering that looks stationary, but it's so covered with snow, you know, we don't know if anything's below that or not, but next year I'd like to go back and take a look at this. Maybe there'll be less snow. Maybe there's a place for the Ark right underneath this cliff. Now, you see the finger glaciers that go down the hill and tend to flatten out down there at the bottom. Now, when we saw this area, we got rather excited. Those glaciers are flat and they're stable, we thought. But you can see the weather was beginning to get a little rough, and we didn't care to go through another storm. So we decided to go back to camp, go down the mountain, and come up from the other side. We had run out of provisions anyway. But on the way to this area, well, the Lord had opened doors throughout the whole trip, just in miraculous ways. I've told you about a few of them. But as we were going to this area that we thought held so much promise, the Lord saw fit to close the door, and he closed it rather dramatically. I didn't come along on this particular climb, but the three that did were awakened in the middle of the night by the sound of gunfire all around, bullets flying through their tent. Well, they were herded out of the tent and taken off somewhere else while bandits stripped them of all their gear, and they were forced the next morning to come back down the mountain. Caused quite a stir when they walked into town in their underwear the next day. The bandits had taken everything. But the Lord closed the door that day. But he opened the door for a possible expedition for next year. Through that robbery, we made many close contacts, close personal friends with people in authority in the mountain and in governmental places. And they've done all they can to promise us that next year they will cooperate fully with our expedition. They don't know, really, that we were looking for the Ark. I told them we were archaeologists looking for... Well, I didn't spell it for them.